Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, ho, 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 and welcome to Rule of Three Christmas Special, a podcast about comedy. I'm Joel Morris.
I'm Jason Hazley.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works, or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. It's a special edition of Rule of Three because we're going to break the tradition. We're going to talk about something Christmassy. And with us to talk about it is our special guest, the writer, Neil Forsyth.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Hello, Neil.
We got you in because what we want to talk about is the grand nation-uniting Christmas special. That is Eric and Ernie, 1977. Neil created Bob Servan, runs one of the funniest Twitter feeds on Twitter with that, also writes lots and lots of stuff for telly, and has also written the play about Eddie Braben, who is Eric and Ernie's writer. One of the first things in any of these sort of sad clown biopic models that was actually about the Backroom Boys, which I thought was an absolutely brilliant depiction of something that was long overdue on TV. So we thought you could come and tell us it from the side of the harassed writer.
Yes, the emotionally bankrupt writer. Merry Christmas. I think what's interesting with Eddie, and one of the many aspects of him that I think was heroic, is that he was a writer who hated writing. on a visceral level. And then he got the gig writing for Markham and Wise, which was his dream gig, and so he hated it even more because he just suddenly felt unbearable pressure. You know, it wasn't just... He hated writing in general, and then he hated the pressure of feeling that he was writing for this show that was becoming so central to the nation that he just, you know, that kind of pressure just started to expound upon him.
Really. It nearly destroyed him, didn't it?
Yeah, a couple of times he kind of stepped away from the show, and I think you have to be sensitive and you don't want to retrospectively diagnose someone, but I think I think nervous exhaustion would probably be the fairest summary of it. But yeah, twice, I mean, he joined them in 69. He, by and large, left after the 77 special. He went back to some of the ITV stuff, which I don't think was the same on any level. But it was really 69 to 70. But within that, yeah, stepped away twice for, you know, I think about 6 months each time, 72 and 76, I believe.
If you're a fan of Morecambe and Wise and you're a writer who hates writing, the urge must be to go, I wish I could step away and watch an episode of this going out that I didn't write. Because I imagine being really close up to it, your favourite show on television has suddenly had all the joy balled out of it because you're just watching it in a state of anxiety.
Yeah, I think even watching it, you didn't particularly enjoy. I think, you know, we got very close to the family while we were writing it, and they were saying, you know, some of the Christmas shows, you would struggle to be in the room watching it go out until, you know, it's almost like a comedian until he heard those first few laughs, and then he would maybe sort of edge back in. The pressure he felt, and I think particularly in talking about the Christmas shows, as the show got bigger and bigger, he was a very anonymous figure to start with, but then he became famous and recognisable in his own right, and he would get things that started off as a novelty, people in Liverpool where he lived saying, "Who's on the Christmas show then, Eddie?"
All right.
Once you're hearing that two or three times a day and you're already exhausted because you've been up all night writing, you know, these things kind of spiral, and they definitely did too.
It's an extra layer of pressure, or Eric would encourage him to save up sketches from the series, go, "Oh, that's a banker for the Christmas special." The Christmas special was perceived as a qualitative step above what was expected for the week in, week out show. So yeah, there's a feeling, even just on his day-to-day job, that any great idea he had was immediately taken out and put aside for this thing where expectation was so high.
Yeah, I think there's probably a few cases where they felt, well, that episode's got, you know, we've got the three or four that'll be talked about tomorrow, maybe stick that one aside for Christmas. But you've got, I mean, it's the sheer volume of work he did as well. I mean, there were a lot of years they would do the series and the Christmas special. I mean, it's sketch writing, so you're overwriting anyway.
Yeah.
The shows are 45 minutes long.
Really?
When it was Eddie's, there were 30 minutes when it was Hills and Green. Eddie took over, they immediately bumped up to 45 minutes. And then Christmas was an hour. So there was a couple of years where they did, I believe, 7 episodes of the, you know, workaday show, and then and then 1 hour Christmas, and Eddie did probably 90% of the writing.
Good grief.
Yeah.
Well, is that credit that comes up at the end, and it just says, written by Eddie Brayburn? And that's something, I suppose, one of the reasons that people are bothering him in the street is he's the first name on the credits at the end, isn't he?
Yeah.
It's Eric and Lee show at the top, and the next name you see, so they're sort of perceived as a threesome.
Yeah, yeah. And John Ammons, the producer, very much thought of them as a sort of comedy triangle. Mm. That's how he saw them operating. But there was other writers, we should say, people like Cryer and Junkin and so on, who would contribute sketches. And Barry Cryer and John Junkin, they stepped in a more major way the two times that Eddie stepped out. So other people would send him material and it would work its way in, and obviously Eric and Ernie contributed, but Eddie was certainly doing the heavy lifting. And yeah, I mean, just the volume of it, throwing in the fact he didn't like writing anyway, I mean, it's a horrific combination.
Do you like writing?
I do, actually, yeah.
Because I hate it.
Really? You're procrastinating.
I'll do anything apart from write. I'd like to do all the preparation and all the... I'll even go to a room and pitch rather than... I'll do anything to avoid it. And then once I start doing it, I really enjoy it.
But you guys did a lot of sort of room writing and stuff when you were sort of coming through,
yeah,
did you not?
Yeah, a mixture of stuff. I mean, at some point you've got to leave.
Yeah.
It's the dread of leaving the room when the idea was exciting and then going and sitting at a desk and going... When you come up with the idea, it's got all this potential.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's an element in what you're talking about with Eddie Brayburn, with he's writing for his two favourite comedians. It's his dream job. And every single moment from the point he sits down at the typewriter, it can only disappoint.
Yeah.
That's a terrible position to be in.
And you've got to keep putting it in its period place in terms of the writing of it. Like, he sat in his office with a typewriter all day, and he wouldn't come down in the evening, and his family talked about, you know, there'd be a Liverpool game on or something that they knew he'd want to watch it, and he'd think, no, if I come down there, I'm not in the zone and I'm not ready to go. So he's sitting there for about 14 hours a day, and this is pre-email and pre-mobile phones. So he's just sitting there at a table, you know, with a typewriter, which just as a physical act now, I think, seems such an archaic, strange and kind of torturous process.
It feels like being in solitary confinement. It's something that you do, like cruel and unusual treatment. It's a Guantanamo Bay of writing.
Yeah.
You're sort of you're put in isolation and given a mechanical torture machine that has to crush your head.
Sit there and write 10 8-minute sketches about Angela Rippon.
They are long as well.
Oh,
aren't
long
they?
Sketches. Yeah.
I mean, nowadays you're encouraged by sketch show producers now to sub nothing longer than 2 minutes. But these are 8-minute sketches.
Yeah, comfortably. Some of them longer. I mean, everything's long, and the pace within it's slow.
Yeah,
and they just wander about.
It's a funny beast. You know? What we're going to concentrate on today is just to give us some focus to talk about sort of Eric and Ernie and the Christmas show. Is the 1977 BBC Christmas show, which is called Eric and Ernie's Christmas Show. I mean, it's not Morecambe and Wise. It's they've become so friendly now that they've got their first names in. But it's Eric and Ernie's Christmas Show, 1977, which is their last one before leaving the BBC. And it's the one that is cited again and again when people write YOY articles about the decline of communal television. It's the one that the BBC claimed got 28 million viewers, which is like half the nation tuned in to watch it. and ITV then contested that, and apparently they're saying it's 21.3. But it's the one when they say, why can't we have comedy like that that brings the whole nation together? It's this one that absolutely busts the figures, even though when you look at the figures, Mike Yarwood, who was on before,
the same night he got bigger,
got 21.4 million, which means 100,000 people switched off Eric and Ernie. I think that tells a story that the nation doesn't want to face in itself. Look into our dark heart and realise that we were preferring Mike Yarwood at the time. But that's a show that doesn't get repeated. And Eric and Ernie, as a product, as a nostalgia project, the product that we still talk about and hark back to as that's the ideal double act partnership. That's what Ant and Dec aspire to. That's a lot of it rests on the sheer number of people who tune in to watch this one show together.
What guest stars have we got on the show, Eric? I didn't actually...
None!
None?
None!
You mean nobody? No guest stars at all?
Nobody will work with us anymore, and they've all tumbled.
Well, there must be somebody needs the money.
Well, there's only one.
Who's
there's one fellow who'll work with us.
Who?
What's his name? Elephant John.
No, you mean Elton John?
Him. It was on the last Christmas show.
Oh, we don't.
Sang the musical song, all sentimental, and got laughs.
No.
So it's 1977, Eric and Ernie Christmas special. It's a show I think I would admit I've probably seen more in clip form than as a show. This might be the first time, maybe even since it went out or since it was first repeated, that I've sat through the whole thing. And I think they're very interesting to watch as the whole thing, because Eric and Ernie, for years, there was a few Christmases ago, watching about four separate clip shows of Eric and Ernie that were on various channels. I think I watched the Andre Previn sketch four times. Never got bored with it because it's really good. But it's consumed as pre-digested nostalgia. But what's really interesting is to watch this and go, this is a product of that light entertainment industry with these guys in it. What does it actually look like? And it's very different than I was expecting.
Again, like Neil, I thought it was very slow. I was surprised at how long it was, and I was surprised about how little of it I recognised. I mean, the sequence that probably everybody knows from this one is the newsreaders singing There Is Nothing Like a Dame from South Pacific, which is, you know, an iconic bit of TV.
We got sunlight on the sand, we got moonlight on the sea, we got mangoes and bananas you can pick right off a tree, we got volleyball and ping pong and a lot of dandy games. What ain't we got? We ain't got games.
But it's surrounded by lots of non-iconic TV. Well, that's not a bad thing to say, because if you make an iconic bit of TV, well done, you've won, definitely, yeah, yes, no exactly. question.
There is absolutely nothing like the frame of a
But things like the start, it opens with the Starsky and Hutch parody, which probably by those standards was quite high production values.
There's cars driving through boxes,
yeah,
a Mini with a little stripe up the side, and they've definitely got the right jumper and nearly the right leather jacket.
They have, but they haven't really tried. It's called Starkers and Crutch, and they haven't really tried to render Eric and Ernie as looking anything like Starsky and Hutch. They've had a go and missed. And in that respect, it reminded me a bit of something like what Vic and Bob would do when they do parodies, yeah, yeah, or pastiches, whatever. It doesn't look like it, but it reminds you of it. You know, we know that Lloyd Grossman doesn't have a sort of, you know, 14-inch forehead, you know, and he doesn't float when he walks, you know, but it dials up the thing and then skews it slightly. And I think they were doing this here, but probably with a different motivation behind it.
I think it's that you mustn't... You tuned in to watch Eric and Ernie, and the first sketch is them dressed as two other popular characters at the time. But you have to be able to see an Eric and Ernie through it. Otherwise, there's no point to them losing themselves in character. No. It's interesting to watch. Whenever they do one of their plays, What I Wrote, the joke is it's just Eric and Ernie mucking about no matter what wigs they've got on. What's strange watching that Starkers and Crutch sketch, which has got, it's done on film, they're properly costumed, sort of properly made up, and it's paced like a title sequence. It's a bit like the Beastie Boys Sabotage video. It's like a pastiche of a cop show.
Yeah,
opening.
But Eric's still got his glasses,
yeah,
on.
Yeah, what's great is you can see through them, because they've realised accuracy isn't funny.
Yeah.
What you're watching is you want to see Eric and Ernie dressing up. There's a lot of this that feels like the same. It has something in common as a piece of light entertainment with Mamma Mia, I think. When you see newsreaders hoofing and you see Eric and Ernie dressing up, this has given us comic relief, mm-hmm, as a comic tone, which is what the nation enjoys is someone dressing up, being game, doing a turn. And that Starkers and Crutch sketch doesn't say very much about American cop shows or Starsky and Hutch or imports. It says something about Eric and Ernie and them being a bit low rent, low budget, and it being funny watching them not be able to do it and falling over and hitting their groins. But the central joke appears to be, isn't it fun watching Eric and Ernie dress up? It is an end-of-term rag stunt.
Yeah, but you've hit on something there, which is that Eric and Ernie are never in character in sketches. They're never playing the characters in the sketches. They're always just playing Eric and Ernie. Everything they do is, to one extent or another, front cloth patter, which is what the comedians used to do in front of the curtain. So it was the kind of the talking to the audience bit, not the being in character bit. And they're not in character for this. They're not playing Starsky and Hutch. They're playing Eric and Ernie dressed up.
Yeah,
and I think what's interesting is that the most successful sketches are where you get more of the Eric and Ernie,
I
think a lot of what Eddie Braben did was to make that transition from Morecambe and Wise to Eric and Ernie, and it was about what he was particularly interested in was getting that off-camera relationship into the TV. And when you're talking about the front cloth stuff, he was trying to knock a little bit of music hall out of them, I think.
Really?
And make them engaged with each other as individuals. Like, the famous story was that he wasn't a particularly big fan when he was first asked to go and meet them.
Right.
Because he knew them from a much earlier incarnation. He'd seen them second from the bottom of the bill at the Liverpool Empire.
So legendarily, they went terribly down on TV. They had that terrific review, wasn't it? Said that, what's the definition of a television? The box they buried more.
Yes, exactly.
They were not, like, their television series were regarded as quite creaky, and they hadn't transferred well from stage to TV, which is unthinkable. Now, when you watch this, we're saying it's a little bit slow and a bit odd to watch, but my God, they are amazing. There's no denying that. You're watching that charisma come through, and you don't want anything, wigs, teeth, anything in the way of seeing Eric and Ernie. And that's what Braben's given them, is a sense of going, as long as you guys stay front and centre and are you.
Yeah, Lose the Performance was his sort of big thing. You know, they'd come up through music hall, and, you know, there's tapes of them early in their career where there's sort of rat-a-tat, Abbott and Costello transatlantic accents, the two of them, you know. So with Eddie, there was the famous story that he wasn't a huge fan, and he went to see them, and they had this long conversation where they were sort of tiptoeing around whether or not he'd be interested in writing for them. And later in the conversation, Eric and Ernie just started, you know, just kind of chatting away very naturally to each other, making fun of each other, talking about great humiliations from earlier in their career. And Eddie said, why don't you do this? Why isn't this your act? And that was a sort of breakthrough moment for them, for him, breakthrough moment for them. And even when he wrote the first script, that was much more character-driven, much more getting into that relationship. It made them feel uncomfortable, and they were very hesitant about pursuing it. Because I think they felt maybe they were giving too much away, almost.
Hey.
What?
I remember the first time you ever stuck your head out of this window.
When was that?
You?
No, I don't.
How you do?
Get out of here.
It's blowing a gale. Yeah. It blew your wig off. And it landed in that garden down there. Yes. A little old lady came out and gave it a saucer of milk.
That's what you're trusting, I think, when you watch them. And I was trying to work out what I was watching, because as a comedy writer, you're regularly toiling under the shadow of the great works that are supposed to have happened, Fawlty Towers or whatever. And this is definitely something that comes up when anyone tries to write light entertainment. It turns up regularly. They go, can't we do something with an Eric and Ernie feel? Can't we do something with this? Because it's so fondly remembered. And you look at it, I was trying to work out technically what are they doing? And all it is being themselves. Even at points where they're meant to be lost in character, they're meant to be doing a play or doing a sketch, there's very few times where you can't see them. And so what you're asking to do to emulate this is something that's impossible. I think it's something that Anton Deck used to manage on Saturday morning TV.
Yeah.
You could see them through them being in a friend's pastiche. They borrowed that very well because it was just their relationship. But I don't think it's something that you can fake. And it's something that's amazing to sort of say that Eddie Braben, who's a writer, said, actually, I can't write this, weirdly. I have to write you being you, which is a very difficult thing to admit.
I think it's the thing that elevates a good double act when they become more than the sum of their parts.
Mm.
So it's the two of them as individuals, but more importantly, it's the relationship. And I think that's what Eddie did. He wrote a lot of sketches where he was creating a situation that would touch on that central relationship and let them play off it. And he also redefined the central relationship. So the play What I Wrote was the big breakthrough for him. I think the biggest thing he did was he almost created Ernie. You know, Ernie was a very traditional straight man before Eddie came along. There was a lot of, and then what happened? And what did you say to that? You know, that was a lot of what Ernie's role was in sketches. And he just hit upon this idea of the frustrated playwright, and you just immediately got this window into his character. So I think what Eddie did in sketches like that created this premise that he knew they could then just play off. So Ernie's a frustrated playwright. He's got his own hopes and dreams.
Yeah.
And then the second part of it was with Eric's relationship with Ernie. Eddie's feeling was this should be more brotherly. It was this idea, you can knock him, but no one else can. So that's
got when the Andrei Previn sketch is the perfect example.
Exactly,
of that.
Exactly.
Total faith in each other.
Yeah, exactly. So that's when Eric became this shield between Ernie and the audience, and he'd be stepping forward and saying, "No, no, you know, give him time, give him time. Bit of respect, folks. Bit
I
of respect.
Him, you can't."
Exactly, and that's lovely. I think
the play what I wrote setups because this one, the 77 one, they've got Penelope Keith in who just knocks it out of the park. She's lovely at this.
Brilliant.
She's
isn't
so
she?
The big laugh out loud for me while we're watching it was.
Penelope, I must say, it's really great to have you on the show. We're really thrilled, aren't we, Eric? It really is marvellous.
Thank you very much, Kermit.
You're supposed to get Ernie as Kermit. She throws it away. She swallows the line, so you're not sure you
How
heard.
Are you, Derek? Oh, I am sorry, Mr. Moron.
But she's got a brilliant persona for this in that she is very dignified, very high status, yeah. and very, very popular actress. But she's brilliant at playing I don't get the joke, yeah. which is what she does, Margot. And she's doing a lot of stuff like I don't realise you're laughing at me, which she plays with a straight face. And obviously she has got a terrific sense of humour and knows exactly what the joke is, which feeds brilliantly into the play what I wrote, which is obviously Ernie has sort of tricked great actors and actresses into being in his terrible bits of writing. But what I thought was interesting watching that again, and it's a long sketch, and this is 20 minutes of your hour is set doing Cyrano de Bergerac with Penelope Keith, is realising that saying that Ernie wrote it raises it above what it actually is, which is all variety shows would end up with the big set piece. Take It From Here would, Cracker Jack did. You do your play based on a popular film or thing, you do an extended sketch. But that was always just an extended sketch that the writers had done. But saying it's Ernie's means that every one of those low grey jokes has got character in it.
Yeah.
Someone thought that was a good line.
Yeah.
Roxanne! I love you.
Roxanne, I love you.
I love you, Roxanne. Yes. But alas, you are only a child.
On my last birthday cake, there were 21 candles. Weren't there, Serrano?
There was on my slice.
I remember finding this writing myself. Whenever you want to do something done badly, because things being done badly is funny, but it's much funnier if you know which idiot made that shit thing. When you can see through to the production, those sketches, which are just every joke you can throw at the French Revolutionary War or whatever, get a backbone and a spine by saying Ernie wrote them. And that's a stroke of genius that no one else had thought of doing.
Madame, you're beautiful.
How did your nose get so long?
It was where my nanny used to lift me out of the bath. It could have been worse. Or better.
You're not pastiching the original material. You're pastiching someone's attempt to write the original material. And that is much funnier.
It allows them to do what they're always doing. It was interesting watching for what are the tropes? What are the tricks? What is a Braben, Eric and Ernie joke? And it seems to be that there's a sketch motoring in a certain direction and Eric is sitting on top of it, riding it, not quite in the car, waving at you, the audience, while the car's motoring on. And everyone else is keeping the sketch on course. Angerad Rees is keeping it on. Ernie's keeping it on.
It's a beautiful young lady.
Oh?
Beautiful young lady who's been entertaining millions of viewers every Sunday
Pardon?
Night. Millions of viewers.
Oh, that's a relief.
And Eric is mucking about and sort of he's making you, the audience, laugh, but also he's trying to crack up his stars. And the key to the enjoyment appears to be watching it on the edge of collapse.
Yeah.
They found hysteria in there.
Yes, and I think they found a little bit too much hysteria. I mean, I think there is a little bit of sort of fake corpsing you get from Ernie, and that's what's...
Is that an arson in the Royal Docks you can get killed for now?
Yeah.
Fake corpsing.
But I think you're right. I think if you distilled most of these sketches down to the premise, you've got about 30 to 45 seconds probably. You know, and that, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I think talking about the length of them and the timing of it is true. It's a very papery premise, I think, on a lot of these things. And like you say, it's that very deliberate knocking it off kilter throughout and then frantically trying to bring it together.
It's the enjoyment you get watching a school play go wrong. Obviously, you framed it beautifully in the Ernie sketches, but actually all their sketches have got that quality. What I was fascinated by with watching what the tone of an Eric joke is they're kind of dad jokes. Mm-hmm. They're like the best. He's like the nation's nominated dad. There's no way that someone will say, "Have you got the scrolls?" without him saying, "No, it's just the way I walk." They are dad grade levels of usually a very, very clean double entendre or a quick. It's almost like Tourette's. There's no way he won't respond when a feed line comes past.
Go and get the chickens.
What have you got for me?
I've got two in the circle.
I had noticed.
I could let you have one in the stalls.
They all say that.
I can can give you two in a box.
Now, there's a novelty.
And it's delightful. But you go, what else is there in this sketch apart from, by this stage, by 77, it's just as many feed lines as can be in the sketch as possible for Eric to, he's returning serve constantly. Yeah. And you're just enjoying the speed of it because he's brilliant at it. But actually, the calibre of the jokes, really eggy, some of them.
And very transferable jokes as well. You just feel that, you almost feel sometimes Eddie just went down and dropped off a big sack of one-liners.
And
they sprinkled them across this dozen shaky premises they had.
If I've got Valerie Leon in the sketch with a low-cut dress, we know we've got five zingers that Eric can throw off.
Yeah, will you love me when I'm old and ugly? Of course I do. Yeah. Stuff like that. You just go, you can put that anywhere, can't you?
It's
a completely portable bit of material.
The mechanics of putting the show together, I think, probably reflected a lot of that. Eddie was, you know, such a brilliant line writer.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, the ice cream line and things like that. Yeah. It was just instant line writing. And I wonder how many premises he was supplying, you know, or how many times it was a loose framework that maybe the boys and John Ammons gave him, and he's then sort of almost
pouring
in the blanks. I think there was a bit of both, really. And I think it's no coincidence that some of the sketches, the very basic premise, were historical, you know, like Andre Previn, for example.
That's
an
old Hills and Green.
An old Hills and Green from their earlier show. And even in the, you know, the stripper with the breakfast, I was reading, some people say that came from a Benny Hill sketch, you know, and I think there's probably a lot of the premises that were either historical or very transferable or pretty flimsy. And then, it's just this constant layering of lines from Eddie.
Do you know how he wrote? Did he just bank lots of one-liners and then throw them into situations? Because it doesn't feel like at any point particularly he started with the situation in these things, does it?
No, well, there's a couple of things. I was in Liverpool a couple of weeks ago with the Brabens. The Liverpool Council had a big reception for him at the Town Hall in a local exhibition at this place called the Floria, done this incredible Eddie Braben exhibition, including recreating his study. Tiger print wallpaper and everything, and the TV sketched on the wall. But I was talking to one of Eddie's sisters, and she said, oh, he used to just call me up in the afternoon and go, all right then, and he'd just reel off six jokes and then say at the end, what do you think? And she'd pick out one or two and he'd say, right, same time tomorrow. And it was that it was gag writing, you know.
Right. So you can see he's writing at the level of gag, and the success or failure of a sketch is very often down to how many lines Eric can get in as the sketch is motoring along. Yeah. By the time you get to 77, watching this, I thought there actually aren't any sketches in this. He's lost the sort of Morny Stannets, the little one-off standalones that you could sell to someone else. And all of this is in the key of Morecambe and Wise, and not even just Morecambe and Wise, but Morecambe and Wise Christmas. So it's all dependent on celebrities. There's a lot of clever editing. It's all stunt stuff over which he sprinkled some absolutely belting one-liners.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a couple of things. It was just that I think they knew it was the last BBC show. I think there's a little element of playing the hits, you know, like this is, I think, the third Newsreader Christmas sketch.
Andrew Rippon's done There May Be Trouble Ahead.
Yes, that's right.
And then this one, she comes back and does a ridiculous faster and faster can sequence that makes very little sense. It's just for the editor,
that's
really.
Right. Well, bringing back Angela Rippon.
Yeah, which was supposed to be a big secret. Apparently, someone was supposedly fired for leaking that Angela Rippon was in it. Going, God, Angela Rippon being in Eric and Ernie is not a big shock.
Yeah, it was the front page of, I think, the Daily Mirror or something.
Really?
BBC production staff had leaked Rippon's return,
It's doing that, and even down to the extent of doing the hits, as in, at some point, Eric looks out the window of the flat and doesn't do He Won't So Much Ice Cream doing that speed. He goes,
is that an ambulance?
No, it was Chartella going on for his lunch.
You've come up with a second, not as good, but still a decent punchline to an ambulance going past.
I think the caveat I would say about, I mean, Eddie, there was certainly a lot of iconic sketches that he did think up the premise. The one that springs to mind is the thing which is true, which I had in the show, which was Eddie stuck for inspiration drawing a TV screen on the wall of his office and sitting staring at it. He did do, and that was in his memoirs. And the sketch that he envisaged after about an hour of staring at this blank TV on the wall was the Augie oversized puppet coming through the curtain.
Oh, that's a brilliant sketch.
And he said he envisaged that on the wall, and that's how he came up with that. So there was certainly a fair amount of kind of premises that came through as well.
This is the birth of the language of celebrities in sketch shows, how you use them, how you do comic relief, how you do Children in Need, that it's to do with playing with people's characters and perception of them and playing bathos with them and things. So they do lots of that. And you think, well, hang on, if you just did a sketch that was about, I don't know, someone in a garden centre, it would feel really small. So it feels that every single one of these things is a little treat. They're little presents to the nation. And the thing that really struck me, because Eric and Ernie are regarded as this nation uniting force, and particularly this show, this one show, was that all the jokes they're making are about other nation uniting forces. So there's a joke with Angerad Reese about Poldark, which everyone was watching. They do Starsky and Hutch, which everyone's watching. They meet the stars of Dad's Army in a steam room that everyone's watching. Penelope Keith from The Good Life that everyone's watching comes on.
And Bryce and Eddington in one shot.
Yeah, all the jokes are about, not only are we all united to watch Eric and Ernie to celebrate together at Christmas, everyone tomorrow will have watched this, but they will remind us of all the things we did together this year. And they've got within the heart of these Christmas shows is a sense of the nation all getting together and saying, what should we make jokes about? And I think you'd struggle to do that today because of atomised culture.
Yes,
and I think
exactly.
What people remember nostalgically isn't just that everyone watched Eric and Ernie, but Eric and Ernie celebrated all the other stuff everyone had watched.
Go on, hang about, love. We're waiting for Angerad Reese to come on.
It's lovely to have you on the show, Angerad.
Thank you.
Eric?
Yes?
Your hand.
I know, I've got another one here.
He's watched all of your series, really.
I didn't know you were a fan, Eric.
I'll tell you something, Angerad. I was thrilled when I realised that you'd escaped. From Colditz.
Everyone recognised those newsreaders.
Yeah.
Everyone knows Frank Boff and Philip Jenkins, of course, no one knows anymore. He's the Horst Buchholz of the Magnificent Seven newsreaders. Peter Woods, by the way, who comes out at the end and does that sepulchral, yes. There is nothing like a. Yeah. Was 46. I looked up, I
what?
Thought. Because my brain went, he must have been about 84. No, he's 46 years old when he comes out as the oldest man on earth.
He got baggy very young, didn't he?
Yeah. Bloodhound face looming out of South Pacific.
He's Justin Webb's father, isn't he?
Is he?
Yes.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
But all those things are jokes that you only get if you're part of the British nation. If you've all been agreed we're watching Poldark,
you'll get
that joke. You'll get who she is.
And there's a small canvas of celebrity then, and it's three channels and huge viewing figures.
Yeah.
And I don't even know who presents the news at 10 now, to be honest. Yeah. But, you know, these were people that were in the living room, in the family. You know, the level of hysteria that's having these people kind of dancing about a stage.
It's quite sweet. It reminded me of, when you go to a pantomime, go to a regional pantomime. The joy at a regional pantomime isn't the big star from Only Fools and Horses who's come down. It's the postman who's playing Widow Twankey. And there's a real feeling that this is the national village panto, that everyone's dressed up, and Eric and Ernie have dressed up as American cops, and the newsreaders all dressed up as sailors. Because you know these people, they're from your village. And the village was the three channels and what we'd all watched that year. Which is one of the reasons it feels so warm.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think you're right that they did sort of invented this celebrity in amusing situations and then sort of ran with it. And I think almost as part of that, what I enjoyed watching so much of the material was when you could see those clear callbacks to their music hall beginnings that have somehow survived years of television production, you know, and years of thinking, oh, we could just bring in, you know, the boy from The Weather and get a big laugh here. But it was often throwaway lines from Eric, just old music hall jokes. But a couple of really nice little nuggets. And one of them is the Janet Webb coming down at the end. So Janet Webb coming in at the end for the majority of the Mork and Wise shows and soaking up the applause. She'd come down the stairs out of nowhere. It was never explained. And this was George Formby's wife.
Right.
This was them taking the piss out of the fact George Formby's wife would memorably join him for the applause at the end of the show.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that just clung on right through their sort of BBC years.
Wow. This is, I mean, 77, this is pure television. A lot of the jokes that you're really enjoying this are editing jokes. There's nothing like a Dame is an achievement of editing. I mean, legendarily, that Eric said it wouldn't work. And it was only when he saw the assembly together with the seamless cutting between the newsreaders and the acrobats that he went, oh, it worked.
And cried at the edit room.
Did he?
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's a test. And the Angela Rippon callback, it only works because they can speed up film. A lot of this is tributes to editing. The Elton John joke only works because of fast cutting and dropping things in. So there's a nice link between that world of music hall caliber jokes and jokes about the pit band and the swishing gold curtains and things, and an incredibly, at the time, modern use of television and celebrity and references to national communal culture that were absolutely bang up to the minute and brand new. And I suppose that's why Eddie drew a picture of a television in the corner of his room to say, I've got to imagine being in the audience. I've got to imagine what a television can do. Because it's different than what you imagine when you look at a blank page, which is what can these two performers do?
The other big visual development for them, and nothing but a Dame's part of this, was the arrival of Ernest Maxine. So when Ernest came in to produce when John Ammons left, around 74 it was, I believe, he came from the Minstrel Show, and he was a sort of, you know, it's a lot of comedy, but also a big song and dance man.
Well, he's credited as choreographer in the credits before he's credited as
he'd worked with them. Yeah, and then he took over fully as the producer, and he pushed them in that big musical performance direction.
That gives you the stripper. Does that give you Singing in the Rain?
Gives you Singing in the Rain, yes, and gives you the stripper. And what was interesting about that was part of that was the development of televisions over those years, and they did have the every year was exponentially better colour televisions, so he was urging them to take advantage of that.
I suppose Nothing Like a Dame is filling quite a big screen comparatively.
Hugely.
So I imagine that's for a bigger television.
Yes, exactly. And frames per second, yeah.
Yeah, you can get seven newsreaders in panoramically in a way that would have been just dots. You wouldn't be able to see their faces, I suppose.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about that was that Ernie was far, far more keen to move in that area than Eric, and Eric was extremely hesitant, resistant. Ernie wanted to go to Hollywood. You know, I think one of his books is called Still Heading for Hollywood or something like that. And he was massively drawn to that, and Eric felt a little bit clumsy and awkward, I think, in those situations, and you know, he was much comfortable just rooted to the spot, that kind of music hall, both facing the audience and so on. So
that's interesting, because one of the very unfair things that happens is that because Eric is dominant in the comic partnership, the feeling that it's one man with another guy next to him. But when you think about those classic Eric and Ernie sketches, you remember Eric's patter, but when you name the 10 best Eric and Ernie sketches, they're the kind of sketches that Ernie really wanted to do. They're the big ones, they're the visual ones, they're the ones that are totally television.
Yeah. It's funny when you watch those early musical numbers, you can see Eric's discomfort during the performance. It's unvarnished. You know, you can see, like, Billy Connolly always talks about ballet dancers. Surely at one point of every performance, a male ballet dancer thinks, what the fuck am I doing? And I think you can see that flash across Eric's face through some of these early musical numbers.
Was that, I saw it dramatised in the thing with Victoria Wood in it, but Ernie came from more of a sort of soft shoe shuffle background as a child.
Yeah, it was him and his dad. He was a child performer with his dad, and they came down to London and auditioned for one of the big kind of vaudeville acts. He got signed and his dad didn't.
Oh my God.
No. Okay, it must have been a long journey home. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I think he was 12 and they split that day and he went off on his own. He was Britain's Mickey Rooney, that's what he was known as.
Right.
Yeah, he was going to be this big star. So, and that was always interesting, the dynamic as well, because yeah, it was in Victoria Wood's film of it that he was the big star as a kid and Eric was sort of lucky to be with him, and then Eric's mum suggested they get together as a double act when they were 14, I think it was.
But it's using their strengths, and what I suppose you've got with, now we're not talking about just about Eddie Braeburn, what we're talking about Ernest Maxon and John Ammons, is an understanding of the dynamic between them and what they could both bring to something. And to add Ernie's Mr. Showbiz, Mickey Rooney-isms, gives a quality to the shows that wouldn't be there if it was just Eric being smart.
Yeah.
It's nice to watch those two energies combine. And then when you get something off it, if you're Eddie Braeburn, you go, oh, well, I can read something within that, that then goes into those flat sketches, which are Eric and Ernie the sitcom. That's them as Hancock, as Bob and Terry, as the Likely yeah. Lads.
We've had a few laughs in this place.
Oh, we certainly have.
Remember when we used to sit on the settee and talk about Terry Aston Street School?
I forget.
You always said that when I said Terry Aston Street School. Was it on account of Miss? Huh?
Nothing to do with Miss, nothing at all.
You never did tell me. Why did she keep you in? She always keep you in after school. Every night she kept you in after school.
I said forget it!
You never did tell me, and tell me, go on. Love your friend.
If you think I'm going to stand around here and talk about such a little thing, you're mistaken.
I don't want to know what she said, just why she kept you in.
They would have worked as a flat share double act.
Yes.
Because they have a different dynamic. They have different aims. They're heading in different directions. They're a double act where there are, when the cheap way of doing a double act is one of you wants to sing the song and the other one wants to stop you singing the song. But they're so much more complicated than
that.
Well,
that's boom. Oh, yatatata. Yeah. That's exactly what that is.
That's the basic version of that. And then what they've found is a much more rich and layered one where they both want to do something brilliant, but very slightly different. And they're both slightly uncomfortable in the other guy's mode.
Yes,
which
exactly.
puts them in conflict. It's a brilliant flat sketch in this 77 one.
I think sad, isn't it?
It's one of the best bits of the show is where they're packing the flat down and they keep doing references to leaving the flat and moving to somewhere better paid, richer.
Yeah.
They're leaving the BBC and you know where Eric and Ernie live. They live in Television Centre because you've seen it.
Yeah.
Do you know if, was Eddie well paid?
I think he was pretty comfortably paid, actually, because he'd been with Ken Dodd before, and believe it or not, him and Ken Dodd had fallen out over money.
Whoa!
Yeah. I know. So he, off the back of that, he got an agent, basically, I think for the first time in his career. And I think he was, I think he was well looked after. But also, he wrote a lot for other people. You know, the times where he was fit and well and found pockets of time, he would rattle off scripts for all sorts of performers, even within the Morecambe and Wise years, and then worked very, very steadily after. You know, his last job was writing for Ant and Dec.
Really?
On CD UK, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he wrote for those sketches?
Oh, I must try and remember this correctly. Someone told me a fantastic story. Oh, I think Rufus Jones, who plays John Ammons in this and is a mutual pal of ours, he told me that he was chatting about Eric Ernie and me to, I believe, Merwenna Banks, who said she did a writer's room, I think it was on CD UK, and there was a sort of slightly elderly guy in the corner and chipping in jokes for the morning. She suddenly realised to her delight that this was Eddie Braeburn. So.
Amazing.
Isn't that, wow. isn't that lovely?
Go to the well, go to the source.
Yeah.
The heritage of Eric and Ernie in terms of how you make these sketches and jokes and how you make a partnership work on TV has been learned very, very well. Ant and Dec, they've maintained that, and they've maintained it by borrowing that dynamic, which is, can you see the friendship through the jokes, and then using their writers very cleverly to never obscure who they are, which I think is the genius of Eddie Braeburn, to do two things. One, to not obscure Eric and Ernie, but also to find who Eric and Ernie were in order that when he wrote in their key.
To come and write for a double act who'd been together for 30 years and to kick off by trying to fundamentally change their relationship was a balls-out manoeuvre, you know?
Really,
I
don't think, boys, here's where you're going wrong.
Yeah. And it worked, you know. And we should recognise that he put them in bed together. That was Eddie Braben.
Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah, well, that's what he said. They wouldn't do it, and he said, well, it was good enough for Laurel and Hardy. And Eric said, well, maybe if I had my pipe. So that was his...
Is the pipe a protection?
It's yeah, like a protection.
Yeah. It's, somehow there is something absolutely the opposite of erotic about a pipe, isn't there?
Yeah. Tian? That's a belter. I haven't done that one for years, you know.
Going back to the flat sketch, the other element of that is Eric wasn't well. He obviously had his first heart attack, which was short when which brought Eddie in, because they lost the original writers. He had his second heart attack, I think, within 2 years of after the 77 show. But he wasn't, you know, he wasn't a well man, and you can see that. You know, he's much paler, he's much thinner. Mm. And that wouldn't have been hidden from Eddie in the writing of it. You know, that he'd been very aware of that. Mm. So I think when you watch the sketch, knowing that and knowing Eddie knows that, I think it's a whole new level of pathos to it as well.
There's a beautiful film we never got of them in that mode, or a beautiful six-part series where they play flatmates that would have worked, because they're still playing all the character tropes that you would do in a sitcom, like he's a miser, that's a wig.
Well, that's the job finished now.
Just the one wallet in that crate, isn't it?
They're playing all the character references and the riffs to get the jokes out of it, and you're going, well, this is the same mechanism as a sitcom.
Yeah.
And they're the few bits I want to go, oh, I could have done 20 minutes of that. It would have been like Bottom.
Yeah. There was a year, I think it was 74, where they didn't do a Christmas show as such. There was, I think they both went on Parkinson, and they went out on Christmas Day. And part of the reason for that, I think, was to give Eddie a break, but also Eric and Ernie had a period where they were very hesitant and unsure about continuing with the sketch show, and they sat in London and heard pitches for sitcoms for a vehicle from kind of every comedy writer in Britain, and waded through them all and just didn't find anything they felt was right. And I think that's interesting, like what was actually holding them back. And
yeah, you're spotting by 77 they're doing greatest hits, they're doing riffs they've done before, they're leaning back on tricks that have served them well in the past. Maybe,
yeah, Penelope Keith coming down the stairs is another one, isn't it?
Oh, it's amazing, because she says, I want to do the big stair routine, yeah, like Hollywood stars. You mean like Shirley Bassey?
Yeah.
It's a double meaning. I'd like to do the big ending from a variety show, but I'd also like to, wink, wink, do the big ending from a variety show like Eric and Ernie do it, where I get to stick my high-heeled shoe into Eric's hat, which is another brilliant, brilliant... God, the physical clowning.
Yeah.
Skirts hiked up, and you think... They did depend brilliantly on game actresses who were prepared to play dignity at the same time. But she gets her dream. She gets to be, not only to do the big Hollywood glamour thing, but to do the big Hollywood glamour thing a la Morecambe and Wise.
Yeah.
I don't think. Yes. I don't. Right, keep smiling.
Had enough?
Yes, I have. I'm going home. Thank you very much.
They didn't recognise Christmas too much in their Christmas shows, which is interesting.
No, that's true.
Yeah, because there's no...
No, there's very little tinsel, and they'd sometimes at the end, you know, right in the goodbye, there'd be a little element of that, but by and large, they didn't. They just cracked on.
Was it to get repeats?
Yeah, maybe so. But it would have been so easy, wouldn't it? But yeah, sometimes in the big waving at the end, there'd be a little element, but you wouldn't see much within the sketches.
Yeah, when they're packing the flat down, you think there should be a little tree they're packing away, but no.
I think it might be part of, as you were saying, the idea that a lot of this stuff is transferable from lines to sketches to everything else. It was just that it was like a factory operation up in Eddie's bedroom, and you know, we'll fit it in where we fit it in. So yeah, I don't think they didn't seem to take on Christmas. I think in terms of Christmas comedy shows, I think the most successful TV shows that have incorporated Christmas episodes are the one where they just bend Christmas to their will.
Sort of thing.
You know, it's not doing a Christmas show. It's, you know, what could Christmas do for us sort of thing, and do for our characters. Well, I think one of the best would have been The Office, you know, the last episode of The Office, the specials. They went out Boxing Day on the 27th.
Very clever.
And they just took Christmas and put it into their show, and there was no compromises made. So it was, you know, The Office, a show that celebrated the minutiae and bleakness of office life. The backdrop was the bleakest office Christmas party ever, with a couple of desks in sort of desultory manner pushed to the side, and the big lad from accounts on the decks, and everyone drinking shit booze out of plastic cups. And that was it, you know, that was their Christmas.
And that brings the nation together. We'll celebrate that. That's the British Christmas at its best.
there was a couple of years where they didn't do a series. They were just so intent on getting the nailing the Christmas show.
And I don't understand how you can make a living off doing one TV programme a year.
Different time.
Different time. Yeah. Budgets are complete. Yeah.
Sometimes we've struggled making a living doing, you know, dozens of TV programmes a year.
We thought about getting framed a picture for the wall of the office, which is of Johnny Spate with his Rolls Royce. When you could be a comedy writer with one show under your belt, doing six episodes, runs, and just drive around London in a Rolls Royce.
Yeah, well, there's a fantastic documentary about Mark and Wise. It's on YouTube. It was an omnibus. I think it was about 73 or 74. They filmed an episode of the Mark and Wise show from conception in Eddie's spare room stroke bedroom through to show night. And it's absolutely fantastic. It's on YouTube. If you go Fools Rush In, it's called, and Mark and Wise. And it's just extraordinary. But you see Eddie tapping away, and you see him go down to London. You see the rehearsal room at Dalgarna Way over behind Wormwood Scrubs.
Yeah.
But what's...
It was called the Acton Hilton, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. But, in terms of a different time of TV writing, they turn up in their respective rollers. Eric with his driver, who just pulls out his paper and sits outside and wander in for a bit of rehearsal and, you know...
I want to weep.
I know. Ernie's in his blazer with brass buttons, and you know, you just wonder where he's off to for lunch after. And
wow,
but you've got an oyster and stuff. You've got an oyster card and stuff, don't you?
Got an oyster
loaded
card.
Up.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's loaded up. Isn't credit.
I've got £12 on my oyster card at the moment. I'm minted.
I tell you what, every time I get in that train, I don't drive it myself. I have a driver.
A driver, yes. Yeah.
What we're looking at here from with Eddie Braben is someone who is part of an era where the writer was a star. That's Spike Milligan, Eric Sykes, Associated London Scripts, Gordon and Simpson. They were Johnny Spate in a Rolls-Royce era where there were a few writers who were just massive names, colossal names, ones you might have seen on credits growing up as a child and thought, I want to be a writer. But it didn't last very long.
No.
And that was a tiny, isolated period where before then, writers were meant to be invisible. Before Spike and everyone started Associated London Scripts, the idea was a writer for someone like Frankie Howard would not be credited because Frankie Howard was supposed to have made up all his jokes, and you would hand jokes in at the back door of the Palladium when Ken Dodd was doing a run, and he'd give you a couple of shillings for it and say, run along, and that would be the job of a comedy writer. They invented the idea of being credited and being a factory system that would produce jokes. And I think you're looking at Eddie Braben here at probably the peak of that period where writers were stars and were seen as so essential to the voice of the front-of-camera talent.
Yeah, and I think what's lovely is he'd made that journey. You know, he was a fruit and veg stall holder on St John's Market in Liverpool, and he used to stand and write jokes in his paper bags.
Wow.
And he sold his first one at Charlie Chester, like you say, out the back of a theatre. So, you know, and then he went and wrote for Ken Dodd for 10 or 11 years and then ended up at Morecambe and Wise. So it was that. It's a fantastic story. I mean, it's a really inspirational story. He's a heroic figure.
Tell me at least one of the paper bags survives.
Oh, I don't know. I'm sure. I mean, I tell you, on cigarette packets, it was all scrawled in cigarette packets.
Really?
And his kids talked about that. His kids said they'd be cleaning up the house or something. He'd be, no, don't throw it. And, you know, almost wow. In a cartoonish way, everything would have a joke scrawled on it. And they had to double check with them before they threw anything out.
Wow.
And, you know, it's a beautiful story. And even the fact that he always went back to Liverpool, you know, Eric called him the Whizzer because at the end of the show he'd just be off and he'd go because he had to run for his sleeper. He didn't even want to stay in London. So, you know, he'd be off in the sleeper home, just wanted to get back to his family, and he'd wake up in his sleeper bed in the morning at Liverpool and he'd another fag packet with jokes scrawled on it, and that would be the beginning of the next show's script, isn't it? It's just lovely.
That's probably why he got exhausted by it as well, though, because writing lots of one-liners is a fuck of a lot of work.
Yeah.
Every one of those requires construction and reconstruction and finessing.
And also, when they don't work at that speed, if you get the wrong word in there, there's a line that I wrote down just because I enjoyed it, which was...
Ah, no, this girl, she is a beautiful dancer.
Have you seen her, Giselle?
Oh, no, I tried to once, but I hurt my neck.
And I can't work out how that works, why that works, what Giselle is supposed to mean. None of that sort of, if you deconstruct it, makes any sense. But it's a dynamite joke.
But he's on to the next one by the time you're deconstructing it. That's the rhythm's right, you know.
But another word in there, another ballet in there wouldn't work.
Yeah.
There's nothing going on in there. Why am I laughing?
Yeah, and can be watched if not necessarily fully understood by a family as well.
Yes,
and the ultimate family in terms of the Christmas stuff was, you know, they did a private performance at Windsor Castle for the royal family,
really?
Eric and Ernie, And it was requested by the royal family. They went off and did a little private performance. And after it, the Duke of Edinburgh complained to Ernie because the Queen had moved Christmas lunch so they could watch the show. He wasn't happy at the... I love him going straight to them with a complaint as well.
I now wish he'd mentioned that in one of her Christmas speeches. Yeah. Or Eric and Ernie could have poked their noses in the background of a Christmas message from the Queen, couldn't they?
Oh, but the second part of his story with Eddie was that he was quite involved with the Writers Guild for a while, the Duke of Edinburgh. And Eddie won, I think, 3 Writers Guild Awards. And at one of them, they had the winner's dinner after, and he was next to the Duke of Edinburgh. And the Duke of Edinburgh said, well, what are you here for? And he said, well, you know, I write there. Morecambe and Wise show, and Duke of Edinburgh went, oh, really? I just thought they made it up as they went along.
And he's
at the Writers Guild. He's giving out the trophies at the Writers Guild Award. Yeah.
Well, I suppose that's a tribute to a really good match of star and writer.
Yes, exactly. It's a compliment. It's a compliment.
The image of the Farrell family sitting around to watch this as reminds me. I'd completely forgotten this until just now. I used to work in vanity publishing. I had a job. I used to edit books that people had wanted to get out that had no sort of business getting out there, and some of them were terrible, some of them were quite nice, and I should just go and proofread them. And I proofread one which was a memoirs of a man who'd run a garden centre for all his life and had written his life story family.
What was the title?
The Answer Lies in the Soil, it was called. And it was oddly amongst these books really sweet. It was a very ordinary man's memoirs, so it's quite pooterish in a nice way. It had a chapter that began, "That reminds me of several further amusing Rotovator anecdotes." So as an Ever Decreasing Circles fan, I warmed this guy enormously. And then it got to a point in his life and he said, "This Christmas," and it was Christmas 1977, "was one of the finest memories I ever had. I'll tell you the story of what happened to us that Christmas." And I thought, oh great, we've hit the point where this is going to really warm up. And I went through and I deleted all the guff around the story, and then realised I got to the end of the chapter and I deleted everything, because all he was talking about was watching Eric and Ernie.
Oh really?
And it was genuinely the highlight of his entire life story. He said, well, he sat down to watch Eric and Ernie, and I went, oh, we'll cut that, because that's obviously getting to the thing that happened. And actually that was it. His family had sat down. It was his happiest memory of his whole life was how nice it had been that Christmas, watching this Christmas special. Yeah. They'd all laughed. They'd all been together. And this was the gift he was giving to his family. It was a memoir where the peak incident was sitting down to watch this. And I went, oh my God, I feel like the biggest prick. I've just deleted your happiest memory. So I went with a red pen into the boardroom and wrote, "Stepped." I replaced in his memoir the best thing that ever happened, which was Eric and Ernie. And it's just that's what the nation's relationship was with them, was that them doing something like this could be your happiest memory.
Yeah, isn't that lovely? I mean, how much and the impact and the permanence of their work as well. It's even the people that were in it, like Andre Previn, talked about getting in taxis in the 90s in London and just waiting for the driver to call him Mr. Preview and then, you know, and it was life defining.
It's Elton John, isn't it?
Hey,
Elton John.
I'm supposed to be doing the Morecambe and Wise show.
Oh, is that finished?
It's over.
We're the cleaners, the whole thing's finished.
Yeah.
They've gone. The one with the glasses was marvellous.
Yeah. I liked it. I liked the little one.
Yeah.
They didn't do one joke about Des O'Connor.
Probably my favourite gag in this whole show is the caption that comes up in Cyrano de Bergerac. This film was released through fear.
That's classic. That is him as a writer. That is a radio gag. That's a Spike Milligan gag. That's a Bob Monkhouse of a gag. That's a really good, clean writer's gag. That.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, I suppose that's when you're seeing him not writing through the mouths of Eric and Ernie. That's just when he's doing his on-screen captions and things.
Playing with format and things.
He's a pure... The technical writing in this is as good as anybody. It's lovely.
Yeah.
Really clever, very witty. And him expressing himself totally, I think. And joyous to watch.
His book's brilliant. I really recommend his book, The Book What I Wrote.
Oh, wow.
It's really funny.
I read that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And you know, I stole wholesale from that, you know, along with the YouTube documentary. But it's he really draws beautiful scenes through the whole writing process and his time with the two of them. And it's laced a little bit with pathos as well. I mean, he was so immersed in writing for them that what's... I think sort of charming and sweet and a little bit sad in the book, he talks about for years after Eric's death still hearing Eric's voice and still writing jokes for Eric, you know.
Wow, really?
Yeah, he does so in the book. This is in the 90s. He's still writing lines and thoughts that he has that Eric could deliver. And...
So there are three people in that bed.
Yeah.
It's a sleeping partner, a trio. What a beautiful... And that's I'm going to say that is a lovely place to end, just to pay tribute to Britain's Best Double Act and the third man in Britain's Best Double Act and the work they did. And even when we're watching here something which is probably then past their best, you can still see how brilliant they were. And what you're watching is almost the ghost of that brilliance you're still enjoying them and what they can do together as a trio.
And so are they. That's the other thing. Is that the how much they're enjoying themselves just pours out of the screen. It really does.
Very much so. Lovely.
Thank you. Thank you for coming in and talking about Eric and Ernie and Eddie Braben with us. Thanks, Neil.
It's lovely. Thanks for having me. Winking sunshine in your smile, bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.